All right, welcome back to The Poet Delayed. My name is Scott Edgrim, the host. I am here today with Tyler Mathis, a good friend of mine for 4+ years, but we've known each other unknowingly much longer than that.
Yeah.
And excited to sit down. We've been talking about doing an episode for, gosh, a year and a half plus probably.
Yeah.
And you finally found the right poem. After searching everywhere, up and down, reading countless books of poetry, writing countless verse, it just came to you. Yeah. And so you've chosen the poem that we are going to read and discuss today, and I'm going to have you read that. If you would, just read the poem and tell us all a little bit about, you know, what you were thinking, like why it resonated with you, and then let's just kind of discuss it.
Okay. All right. This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
Okay. And the poet, by the way, Philip Larkin.
Yeah, Philip Larkin.
I never heard of him, but so how did you come across this? What resonated with you about it?
So I guess he's pretty popular in England as a poet. And my wife and I were watching an episode of Ted Lasso in the third season, and I guess spoiler alert, but Ted's mom comes to visit him in England, and he clearly has some unresolved issues with his mom, and it goes through that in the episode. But he's at the pub, May's pub, and he's sitting alone, and his mom is having a conversation with Beard across the pub, and Ted just kind of has this, like, he's just observing them, just has this, you know, disconcerted look on his face, and May cites the poem to him. And I was like, oh, I got it. As soon as she finished, I was like, I'm looking it up on Google, like, you know, just, and I think what hit me the most was just that, you know, I relate to it because, you know, that's what I've been learning probably the last, I don't know, 10, 12 years, is just understanding myself and just understanding the impact that not only my parents had on me, but also their parents had on them, you know, on the whole cycle. And I like to do a lot of family history too. And just, you know, it's so interesting to me to, I guess see the resilience of people because of just some of the crazy stuff that people went through, and, you know, like, anyway, so I find that interesting. And it's something people don't like to talk about. You know, you think about like Mother's Day and Father's Day, people are just gushing about their parents. Right. And it's, I don't know that it's always insincere, but we don't really want to look at the dark side. And you know, I think understanding the dark side really helps us understand ourselves and find a path to, like we were talking about before, to break the chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
To hopefully not be as glim as Philip Larkin is about about life, you know.
Yeah, I remember I was talking to my oldest son once, and he was younger. He's still, I think he was in high school. But he said, or maybe even junior high. No, it was probably high school. And he said, Dad, why do like all my friends have issues with their dads? I mean, why do they always have problems with them? And I said, Ian, it's just, you know, no kid gets out of childhood unscathed. I said, maybe you don't feel like you have problems with me right now, but you're going to look back and think, what was that? You know? And sure enough, we've had conversations about stuff that I have done that has was hurtful to him. And I just don't think there's any way to avoid it. But to your point, it is interesting with these Father's Day and Mother's Day. I don't know that we don't want to celebrate mothers and fathers, but I think, you know, at the expense of acknowledging that they're not perfect, that not every mother is an angel, and not every angel mother is perfect, you know, and the same with fathers. But we do get that sense, it seems like. You know, I wrote a poem a long, long time ago. And what was it? Many a noble man has walked the face of the earth, but none more noble, dare I say, than she who gave them birth. Oh, you know? I think that's a sweet sentiment, but that's not always the case.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are sweet, gentle mothers, but then there are also mothers who are devouring mothers, and there's fathers who are kind and gentle, and there's fathers who are not.
Yeah.
And you read Philip Larkin's poem. I mean, the thing about that poem that because I can get behind the first and second verse. I mean, that you know, that's a matter of fact. Like you say, you look at you do family history. It's interesting. It is interesting to see how resilient we are as people. That we don't just completely turn to savagery.
Yeah.
You know, there is a general overall consensus that we want to be kind to each other. Yet we all go through these childhoods where there is, you know, no one gets out of childhood unscathed. But the part of the poem that really strikes me is his last one. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Now, you got a couple kids.
Yeah.
I got 5 kids. Did not heed that. But I guess for me, and we talked a little bit about Philip Larkin earlier, and I think we came to the consensus that we weren't sure if he had kids or not. Is that?
I think he died a bachelor. He was at least not married. I didn't dig in deep enough to know whether or not he ever, you know, had kids with a woman. But
Well, some of my greatest memories and experiences in our life are with my kids. Mm-hmm. So what do you make of that? I mean, I don't think that's really, that doesn't strike me as the way to respond.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, you know, you and I having gone through lots of therapy and worked together on things and supported each other, I think, you know, to me, I'm a very competitive person.
Not as competitive as me. No, I'm just making it a contest here.
Yeah. And it's almost like a challenge. Like, oh yeah, you know, like I'm going to try and be, you know, I often fail, but I'm going to try and be a better dad than my dad was, or, you know, and that's not a knock against my dad, because I do think, you know, they did the best with what they had at the time. And I don't think there was as many resources available to try and figure things out as there is today. So, you know, taking advantage of those resources and being a better dad. And yeah, like there's so much joy you can get out of, you know, those hard conversations with your kids, you know, where you connect because you forgave and they forgave you. And I think because we know we're going to mess them up, right? In some way, we're not going to do it perfectly, but if we can admit to that and not ignore it, I think that goes a long way in healing.
That to me has kind of been my goal as a parent. I mean, I try to do what's right. I sometimes spent, you know, and I don't have the emotional or I respond wrong or I snap or something like that, which is not okay. Right. But for me, like you mentioned earlier, you know, your parents did the best that they could with what they had. And I agree. I mean, that's a reality. know, that is a reality because they got fucked up by their parents. Mm-hmm. And that's what they know. At the end of the day, though, my thinking is, okay, at the end of the day, though, you know, we are responsible for our decisions. We are responsible. And it's not, you know, especially in a predominantly Christian nation or in families, the question of how to treat children and how to treat others is not ambiguous. You know, when you look at the Sermon on the Mount, there's no ambiguity in there about how you treat one another. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Christ's one descriptor of who his followers are is, by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples if ye have love one to another. So it's not ambiguous what parents should be doing, especially towards their children. So yes, our parents were fucked up by their parents, who were fucked up by their parents, who were fucked up by their parents, and we were fucked up by our parents. You know, obviously to differing degrees, mm-hmm. you know, but at the end of the day, there's no ambiguity as to how we should be treating each other, especially our children. And so the thing that I struggle with is, I don't expect my parents to be perfect, but it would be nice if they would apologize or just acknowledge, really, you know, and at the end of the day, I don't want to wait around for an apology.
Right.
You know, but so yes, they did the best with what they had, but there's no ambiguity as to what is expected of a parent with regards to loving their children. I mean, even the New Testament, Christ says, you know, if you offend these little ones, it'd be better that a millstone would be hanged around your neck. Mm-hmm. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
You know, and cast into the sea. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
But, just seems like there's, so I guess I just think, yes, you were messed up. You were wounded, but that's no excuse to not try to understand what your wounds are and to work on your wounds and to apologize. Like, I know I'm not a perfect dad, and, but I want to do the right thing, but I know that I will fail at times, and in place of that, I want to be able to apologize and acknowledge where I fell short with my kids. So those are some of my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, mentioning wounds, I mean, that's where, for me, that's where it shows up. You know, these wounds that I have shows up in my dysfunction with my kids. Like, mm-hmm. if I'm not on my game, which essentially you have to be on your game all the time with your kids. You can't be off, right? Uh-huh. Or they're going to just like nail you for it. But it's those wounds that I received from my parents that show up when I'm, you know, not doing a great job. And so that's, you know, that's where I try and focus on, you know, how can I heal that wound on my own if I'm not going to get an apology, and so that I can then be a better parent to my kids.
Yeah, that's the question, because I think, at some point you come to realization, or either you do sit down, you do get an apology, or you're able to work through it. At least, you know, you're able to have a conversation where you're both open, you know, you and your parents are both open-minded and able to discuss these things. Or you come to a realization that that's never going to happen. And then what do you do? Then what do you do? I guess that comes back to my point as well. Like, okay, I was wounded, and I know that I'm not going to have any closure, you know, for people in that situation. I know I'm not going to have any enclosure in that situation, any closure. So now what is incumbent upon me? Do I hold that in bitterness for the rest of my life? Because I would think that that is just going to pass on down to the next generation as well, that bitterness. Or do you find a way to come to terms with it and move forward, which is hard. It's hard. I think, what do you think about that, or any thoughts? Because I wanted to break down his poem a little bit more, but I want to hear what you have to say about that there.
Yeah, my thought, the thing that comes to my mind is, like, it's, I always thought, okay, I'm going to come to this place of acceptance about, you know, the way I grew up, the way my parents handled things, you know, whether or not they apologized to me. I always thought, okay, I'm just going to get to this place of acceptance and then I'll be done, right? Then right. everything will be good. But I found that it doesn't work that way. I have to constantly work on it. Like, it's a never ending. Like, I have to continue to do the things, like manage. It's almost like having a disease. Like, my wife has type 1 diabetes, and so we often use that analogy.
That's
like,
a great analogy. Right?
You have to manage it or you're going to die, right?
Right.
And so if I don't manage, you know, use the tools that I have to manage my emotional life, then I'm going to die emotionally, I guess you could say. And so it's a constant.
What are some things that you, like, what are some tools that you use, things that you do?
I mean, this right here, you know, probably one of the biggest ones is that I'm not the best at, but I know it is one of the best tools, is to reach out, right, to friends, mm-hmm. to have that support outside of maybe your immediate family, you know, just have that network of people that you can go to. You know, I continue to go to personal therapy and discuss, you know, things, and how that's often what we talk about is, you know, being a better dad, like, and helping my kids. And then just, you know, I have apologized to my kids, often, and that's when I find myself closest to them. Right. Cause I'm not, unfortunately, I'm not a very emotional person. And I find that challenging, to get close to them, to my kids. But, in those moments when I'm vulnerable with them and admit that I'm wrong is an opportunity to come close. But I think too, just, you know, being more mindful, kind of thinking about and meditating about, you know, being calm, you know, remembering, being more of an observer rather than a judge or a critic with my kid, you know, see when they're having a strong reaction instead of like reacting to it, just observing it, I think is something that is helpful. So, and there's tons of things you can do, but, you know, I think those are some good ones.
Yeah. I like that idea of, you know, when they're, you know, we engage with our children differently at different ages. When they're younger, we need to be more involved and more of a decision maker for the little children who are mm-hmm. learning that the stove is hot and don't touch it, so to speak. But then as they get older, then we can start standing back a little bit. I like that idea of not being a judge, not being, you know, not being critical, but also, you know, being available to them to answer questions and to be supportive of them. One thing that I've been understanding and realizing, you know, as I've been working on becoming more healthy and reconnecting to myself, is it seems to me that the real problem is the disconnect that we feel in ourselves. Like when we have a parent who doesn't tell us, or when we have a parent who puts his or her needs above their children's, kind of like have you seen that Gabor Mate video about addiction?
I think I may have, but it's been a while.
Yeah, I've mentioned it here a couple times on the podcast, but just briefly, he just describes that, you know, as children, as young children, we have two main needs, and this is going to be a very brief overview. We have the need for attachment to a caregiver because we are not able at that age, as human babies and young children, to provide for ourselves. So we have to have that attachment to a caregiver. But in addition to that, we have to have this attachment to ourselves, our authenticity. We need to be able to know who we are and listen to our gut and to be able to understand that. And his point is that if that need for an attachment to a caregiver ever comes into conflict with that need for attachment to ourselves, if those two ever come into or conflict with each other, the attachment to a caregiver will always win out because we will die otherwise. And so we lose that attachment to ourselves and we become people pleasers and, you know, and, mm-hmm. and so as I've thought a lot about this, I really go back to that explanation by Gabor Mate, because I think that for me, a lot of my wounds, a lot of the issues that I dealt with was a lack of connection to myself and seeking validation and confirmation externally. And I didn't get that from my dad. You know, my mom passed away when I was 10. I know for sure after that, I didn't get that from my dad. And so I would search for, I mean, I have memories of, I mean, specific memories of craving acceptance and validation from these adults, the parental figures, you know, and losing it with myself. And so I think for me, my understanding that I'm coming to, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, is that, you know, this disconnect inside of me is the problem. Like, I am not connected to myself, because I have felt specifically moments when I am connected to myself and there is a marked difference in my reactions to difficulties, adversity. I'm much more able to manage those. But when I feel disconnected from myself, that's when I get panicky. That's when I get anxious. That's when I start looking for external validation, external support. And I had that realization about a year and a half ago. And I just realized that the only way to solve this pain that I feel isn't to go connect with somebody. It's to connect with myself and to heal that wound. Because and to kind of bring it back to what my point was, is that when we're wounded by our parents, that's the wound that I think of, is like, I am conditionally loved. I am only worth it if I'm showing up in X, Y, or Z way. And so I'd better be that way, regardless of how that reflects myself. And so it's that break. And I think that is what, for me at least, my understanding about myself is that is where it all breaks for me, is that I lost my own value. I lost self-respect. I didn't feel that anymore. And for my kids, and that's why I think you mentioned apologizing to children. I think that is why it's so important. Like, if I do something that offends my children, I always try to apologize. And I followed up with, you didn't deserve that. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have snapped. You didn't deserve that. You're worth more than that, you know, or mm-hmm. you're worth my time to go to these events. You're worth my time to come and pick you up. You're worth this. And I didn't ever feel that as a kid. Does any of that resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. What it makes me think about is, so my oldest, my son, Gabe, he's 19 and he has autism. He's very smart. So he's kind of, I guess, what they call high functioning. But socially and emotionally, he's probably 3 or 4 years behind his peers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of... there's a lot of weirdness. There's a lot of
awkwardness.
Yeah. And there's, I've noticed in myself, there's a lot of resentment because he wasn't like what I expected, right? Mm. I was hoping that he would like sports. I mean, that's what I grew up on, was, you know, baseball, football, basketball. And even later in life, I've, you know, done running and mountain biking. And
by the way, how many days have you exercised outdoor consecutively? Is it still going?
Yeah, it's still going. I think I have to go back and look. I think I'm at like 450 something.
Wow. Okay.
Might be in the 460s.
Okay.
Actually, no, I think I'm in the 470s. Sorry.
I feel healthier just knowing you.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's where a lot of, like, when you were talking about external, like, I had so much of my worth tied to whether or not Gabe is normal and lives a normal life, right? And I've just found that, you know, he's very aware of that too. Like, whether he can say it out loud, he's aware of the differences, right? Between him and his peers, between me and him. And what he needs is, he just needs to know that he's accepted, right? That he's loved. And when I myself am comfortable with who I am, right, outside of Gabe, outside of anybody else in my life, then I'm able to provide that acceptance, right? But if I'm so caught up in, like, what my neighbors think about the way Gabe acts and, you know, all of these things, then I'm not able to be my best self around him, and I'll not be as nice and not be as kind as he deserves. So yeah, that's where that resonates. And I think, you know, I think all kids, that's what they want, right? They just want to be accepted. They want to have the ability to, and confidence to go out and make mistakes and know that they have somewhere to go, you know, after they make those mistakes.
Yeah. I think about that, actually, that concept a lot. It, you know, children, as they're growing up, it's a time to learn who they are and to figure themselves out, and they need a safety net. I was talking to somebody recently about this, that, you know, I was afraid. I felt like I had to make every decision perfectly. I felt like I had to make the right decision. And what I ended up doing then is just not making any decision. I was afraid to fail. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like there was a safety net. I felt like if I failed, I failed. And I still struggle with that now. That's probably the biggest thing that I struggle with, is fear of risk. And, you know, obviously there's different levels of risk. I mean, there's irresponsible risk, but I was afraid to risk anything. And so I just stayed small. You know, I've shared my analogy of my, you know, raft, my raft analogy, you know, with related to life many times on the podcast. And that was it. You know, I wasn't living, but I also wasn't dying. And that's what I just didn't want to be. I was afraid to get in the water and swim away from this little raft. I would rather just stay on this little raft and not die, rather than go out and risk and hopefully have a reward.
Yeah. That reminds me of, actually, I was listening to an interview with Orlando Bloom, who...
Legolas?
Yeah, Legolas, who, by the way, is dyslexic and has ADHD, which I didn't know, so that's interesting. But I guess he's got a new show coming out on Peacock where he does these extreme sports, and they were talking about the people that he was working with, these people that do these extreme sports, like the... you know, the squirrel suit jumping off cliffs and, you know, skydiving, all that kind of stuff. And these people that take these risks, he said they are so much more disciplined than the general population, which I found interesting. Was like, they make sure that they have to everything covered. Yeah. And so I think, to me, you know, that's the parent's safety net, right?
Yeah.
You know, allow the kids to be able to take those risks, because you know, you have a disciplined parent who's going to accept you, who's going to love you.
So. Yeah. I've had this conversation with a couple of my children recently, just like, now's the time, you know, you're in school, college, or, you know, go find out what you want to do. Do some crazy stuff, you know, go figure stuff out. You always have a roof over your head. Here, always have food to eat. Go figure out what you want to do in life, instead of rushing through and being done with it. I mean, you don't have to abide by other people's time frames. You know, do what works for you. Figure it out and enjoy life and have that safety net. And we'll see how that plays out. But I guess my hope is that that maybe we are breaking the chain a little bit, because mm-hmm. like in his poem, he says, you know, the first verse, I mean, he addresses two things. So the first verse is about, your parents fucking you up. They'll add some extra just for you. Oh boy. And then, but they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old style hats and coats. I love that. Anyway, but so then the last verse is, you know, so get out as early as you can, you know, so you can be fucked up as little as possible, and then don't have any kids yourself so that you don't perpetuate this cycle of fucking everybody up. I've never said that word so many times in the podcast, but, you know, we're quoting a poem, right?
Yeah.
It's poetic usage.
Yeah.
And I think that's acceptable. So we'll see. But, so, you know, getting out as early as you can, you really don't have that option, but then don't have any in yourself. And we've been talking about that now, that I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the greatest moments in my life, and the joys in my life, have been with my children. And so, I don't know what to make about Philip's conclusion there, unless he's just trying to be shocking, I guess.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's what's so interesting about this poem, is like the first, the first verse, I think it is meant to shock, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also humorous, right?
Yep.
And then the second verse is still a little humorous, but, you know, a little serious. And then the end is pretty bleak.
yeah.
But I did watch a short documentary. I don't think I finished it, but there was somebody that knew Philip Larkin, and they basically said that he was incapable of loving somebody because he was unwilling to be vulnerable with another person, unwilling to kind of open himself up. And so that's what I see in that third verse, is like, get out as early as you can. Put up that wall, protect yourself. Don't, you know, and then don't have any kids yourself. Don't be vulnerable, you know? So.
Yeah. It's kind of a cop out almost.
Yeah.
You know, rather than fixing the problem, or rather than attempting to break the chain, you're just going to, you're going to break it in the sense that you don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
End of the family line, as Morrissey would say.
Right.
That's interesting. So vulnerability. Yeah. That's a buzzword nowadays.
Yeah.
But the problem, you know what I hate about buzzword? Like, these are true principles, powerful things, but then they start sounding trite because they're used so much. Mm-hmm. And then, so I find myself trying to find other ways to express, like, authenticity. I'm like, I don't want to say authenticity anymore, but how else do you express that? You know, come into my own. I don't know. But we were at men's group the other day, and one of the guys there, someone said reparenting, and he bristled like, oh, I hate that. I hate that. So we came up with parenting once again. So we're going to parent once again ourselves.
Yeah.
But vulnerability, man, there's a line you got to draw. I mean, not everybody's entitled to know everything.
Yeah.
And even the things that you share, you don't have to share every gritty detail of it. But the willingness to let down the wall and say, you know what, this is who I am, and to be comfortable with that for me has been the biggest thing. And also, you become like, all the fears I have of being unwanted or unloved because I feel like maybe there's parts of me that people don't like or won't like if they find them out. Well, vulnerability for me has struck at that fear, mm-hmm. because here I am. Like I was telling you about that poem that I wrote on you, and it was a terrible potential, and I read it on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, and some person, I don't even know who he is, put a comment, and he said, because that's a vulnerable thing for me to do, is to read the poetry out there. And his comment was, I liked the reading, but not the poem so much. And that's my favorite poem, you know?
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I can kind of understand it a little bit. It's not, anyway, I won't even get to
maybe
that.
Maybe it was a bot.
It wasn't a bot. I found the guy.
Okay.
I think it's, I mean, anyway, But, and then his next line was, keep effort. That's that's exactly, keep effort. Read more poetry. And at first I kind of bristled. I was like, oh, who are you? You know? Mm-hmm. But as I've thought about it more, I thought, you know what? That wasn't necessarily a bad comment he left me. So he didn't like the poem. He liked the reading. He says, keep up your effort. You know, broken English. Keep up your effort. Read more poetry. And I thought, well, that's not such a bad thing. So I responded, thanks for the advice.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's the difficulty with being vulnerable, is when you're vulnerable, you're going to put yourself out there and subject yourself to other people's opinions about you. And they're not all going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And so the risk that I run, for me at least, is when I get offended or upset, is to react harshly back. And I'm trying not to do that. And my first instinct was to make some snide remark back at him.
Mm-hmm.
But I paused and I thought, no. And I feel great about it now. It doesn't bother me one bit now. In fact, I'm grateful for his compliment or comment. Maybe that's a Freudian slip. Maybe it was a compliment, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so vulnerability is important, but it's a tool. It's really a valuable tool, and it helps us if we engage it properly with proper intent. Then it's going to invite these criticisms and so forth at us, and we can either remain open and strengthen ourselves, or we can close back up and react negatively against that. So vulnerability is buzzy as that word is, I'm going to continue using it because I don't know another word that is as that describes that process well.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. I was thinking of like opening yourself up, open up, you know, but, and I think that's kind of what you're doing as a parent when you apologize to your kid. You're like, look, I have these wounds. I have, you know,
right,
these issues, and that shouldn't have been what happened to you. And another thing that your comment made me think of is, you know, not everybody is going to like your poem because it doesn't relate to them.
Good point.
Like, you know, and when we're trying to please everybody, right, the whole world, then we're definitely not being authentic.
There you go. We're true to ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And so we're not, we're losing ourselves if we try and be a pleaser to everybody. You know, we're not taking a stand. We're not like having this is what I believe in. These are my values.
Boundaries.
Yeah. Boundaries. And yeah. So I think all of those things, you know, come from opening yourself up and being your true self and not letting outside influences determine who you're going to be.
Yeah. And to add to that, you know, taking into a kind of a boundaries, which is another buzzword, but boundaries to me, I'm still working my boundaries, but the thing about boundaries real quickly, and this relates to what you were just saying, is that if you can set your boundaries, now your boundaries are based on who you are, you know, and what your truths are about yourself. And that's, you know, like who you are, what is acceptable to you. When you can set those boundaries properly, those make so many decisions that you don't have to make them, because what they do is, yeah, a lot of people aren't going to like it, but if you go trying to please everybody, you're not. First of all, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. Second of all, you're going to be attracting people to you on false pretenses, and you're not going to have a deep relationship with them. But when you're vulnerable and you have your proper boundaries, then the people that come to you are your people, and you can connect with them on a deep, authentic level.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, like you and I, like, I feel like you're a brother. I feel like I can talk to you, and I don't feel like I have to be somebody else. But in the past, I just wanted, like, if I wanted to, I reached out, I would cling, or I would chase down, not just like, well, in all types of relationships, friendships, romantic relationships, business relationships, all I would chase and cling. And I'm learning not to do that. I'm learning just, okay, let it go. I'm not going to chase relationships anymore. If they don't just come to me, then they're not meant for me. You know, I mean, you want to put in effort, of course, but if that effort is, if you're the only one ever putting effort in, I guess that's the chasing part. And so I like that, what you said, when you open yourself up and if you have the proper boundaries, so there's the two things, it's almost two kind of, like you're opening yourself up, but you're also filtering mm-hmm. with your boundaries, you're filtering. Because if you are too vulnerable, people will come in and take advantage of you if you don't have the proper boundaries and filters. So you need to open yourself up, be vulnerable, and then have the boundaries that filter the people who come in. Because people who, you know, people will leave. If you have proper boundaries, they don't want to be around you. They'll just leave. And that's, so you don't really have to make those decisions. And it takes a lot of stress. My experience has been that it takes a lot of stress and anxiety in that aspect. Like, I don't have to, you don't have to be my friend. It's okay. Right. You know, yeah. So I like that. What you said, I like that you said that. And the other thing that you mentioned that I really think is important is when we apologize to our children and we are vulnerable to them in that sense, and they see us that way, we are showing them that you don't have to be perfect. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to falter. It's okay. You just mm-hmm. gotta say, you know, make amends where you need to, if you need to. And I think that's a huge one, because when people don't apologize or fail, you know, refuse to admit fault when there is fault, like if I offend my children wrongfully, or even if I, you know, there are times when I, well, here's a good example. This is my son, my 17-year-old son. He said something to me that upset me. I don't think it should have, and I don't think it should have upset me, but it did. And he came to me, and he said, "Dad, I'm sorry if I made you upset." And then he said, "I meant what I said. I still feel the same way I said. You know, I'm not changing. But I didn't want to hurt your feelings." And I was so impressed with that he would stick by his guns of what he thought was right, mm-hmm. but he knew that I had, you know, that what he had said had hurt me, but he's like, "Hey, wasn't trying to hurt you, but I do believe what I said." That to me was a great example of knowing who you are, but also being vulnerable, coming and apologizing, not just saying, "He shouldn't have been upset. What an idiot. Shouldn't have been upset." But he came and he was gentle with me. And that was a good example to me. And then, you know, in another aspect of that, if I do make a mistake, like if I remember same son, I snapped at him once. We were trying to get him to do his homework. He wouldn't do it. And I snapped at him and just said, "You're never going to get this done. I don't even know. I've put all this time and effort into helping you. And you never, you know," which he should have been doing his homework, but he hadn't, but he did not deserve for me to snap at him. He did not deserve for me to yell at him. I know that there were other things going on in his life. His mom and I getting divorced being one of them, a huge, mm-hmm. huge things, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
they were causing problems for him. He did not deserve to be yelled at all, period. And so I was able to go up and say, "Hey, son, I'm sorry. You didn't deserve for me to yell at you. Okay, let's see if we can get back on track with this homework and stuff like that." And my hope is that he and my other children, who I end up apologizing to my kids a lot. I do. Yeah. But I love them, and I want them to, first of all, I want them to know that I love them, and I recognize that I don't do things perfectly, but at the same time, they do not deserve to be on the other end of my anger, especially when it's not them, yeah. when maybe they've done something that triggers something else inside of me, but it's not them, and that's the worst when it's not them,
yeah.
you know? Anyway, those are some of the thoughts that I had of what you're saying, that when we apologize to our kids, it's being vulnerable. It's also showing them that you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect, but it is important to apologize when you've done wrong.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about, we had this total eclipse across the country, right?
Right.
My kids went and saw it with my wife in 2017 up in Idaho, like the total eclipse. And I didn't go. I was like, "Oh, we'll just watch the partial here."
Not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same. So we had planned, you know, 7 years ago that we were going to go to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this road trip planned out, and we ended up pivoting because it was going to be cloudy in Texas, and we were watching these weather maps and all this stuff. So we ended up going to Arkansas. And anyway, I was able to witness, you know, the total eclipse, and it was otherworldly, but
spiritual is the word. I mean, it was, wow.
Yeah. Just that last, just the minutes leading up to it. And the, you know, the crickets chirping and the frogs, you know, starting to make noises. And then the street lights went on as soon as it went total or even before. And, but what I've been thinking about is like, just, you know, how beautiful the sight is. And it's so unique from anything you've ever seen in your life. It's like a whole new world opens up. And it's because you have this dark peace right in the middle. You have this darkness right in the middle. And it shows you this beauty that you never knew existed. This corona, this white light, this softer light from the sun. Yeah, you don't get to see that because the brighter light is always shining.
I like that.
On it. And to me, like, relating to this poem is like, we don't ever want to talk about the dark parts. We don't ever want to have that. But to me, if we're willing to open up and talk about our dark parts, then we can see this beauty that we never knew existed. So anyway, I just been thinking about that a lot, and I thought it related to this discussion a little bit.
Yeah. I love that. I went and saw that eclipse in 2017 in Idaho. Yeah, but, and you're right. 100% is the only way to see an eclipse. And it was otherworldly. It was spiritual. The temperature drops. It has this eerie darkness because it's not like night. It's almost like, actually, I felt kind of like it was like a full moon night.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, that's an interesting concept. That darkness allows us to see this, the beauty of the corona that we don't normally get to witness because of the brightness of the sun. And then relating it to this, I think, is a great point. And I think that's the case with most things. Like, if all we ever do is look at light, I mean, darkness gives light meaning.
Yeah.
You know, that gives light meaning. That's why I always wanting to be filled with light, that doesn't appeal to me anymore. You know, I want some darkness. Yeah. And I feel like I have some. I think it was Rilke. He was talking about, the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. He had this, he did psychotherapy. I don't remember if it was with Freud or Jung or one of their acolytes. I don't remember who it was. But he did a few sessions, and then he stopped because he said, I'm afraid that it's taking this is a huge paraphrase. In fact, it's not even a paraphrase. It's just the concept that it was taking the dark parts out of him that, you know, created his art and his beauty. And I think there's reality to that, you know. Yeah. But we need to see it. We need to understand. I mean, that's a little bit different than what we're talking about in this poem, because I don't want to perpetuate the darkness. I would like to get rid of that darkness. Yeah. I would like to get rid of that. But the fact of the matter, the truth of the matter is, we are fucking everybody up. But, and when we ignore it and pretend like everything is fine and normalize it, that's another buzzword now, normalizing, then that's the problem.
Yeah.
That's the problem. It's, we need to acknowledge it. We need to bring that darkness to the light and just acknowledge it and say, hey, we're not perfect. We're working on it. And, you know, my hope is that this next, you know, my children get married, have families. Hopefully they can look back and think, okay, it's okay to apologize to kids. It's okay to acknowledge that I'm not perfect, that I make mistakes. That's really the only way to go, because it's impossible to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And for me and you, at least, we already have our kids, so we can't we can't undo that.
Yeah.
Not that I ever would, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it was definitely the darkness that and the gloominess that inspired Philip Larkin to to write something that's so grim in it. But then you have the other side, people that are so rosy, and I think everybody else realistically is somewhere in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. We have our dark and our light sides, and, you know, I think, yeah, I totally agree. Acknowledging those dark parts helps us move forward.
When you can't you can't fix anything unless you acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And so you've got to acknowledge it. And it doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. It doesn't mean that's the unfortunate thing is, like, our parents, they did not create their situation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. But the truth of the matter, again, is that, yeah, you didn't put it, but you still got to deal with it. Yeah. You know, you've got a couple options. You can deal with it, or you can just not and perpetuate the cycle.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it's, I mean, when you have, I'll hold that thought. But anyway, yeah. So Philip Larkin, I need to go read some more of his poetry. I have not, this is the only poem of his I've read, and I still need to finish the Ted Lasso's last season.
Yeah. I recommend it.
I like that they limited it to 3 seasons. You know, it's nice to know that, okay, I'm going to watch this and then there's going to be a bookend. Mm-hmm. You know, I watched a season of one show. Great. I thought it was a great show. And they left open-ended. And then they said, okay, we're not renewing it. I'm like, what? I wasted I wasted that day and a half of binging for nothing.
Yeah.
I could have been binging a different show. You know?
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, no, I agree. In some ways it's sad. Like, you wanted it to keep going because. Mm-hmm. Because it is just so, like, uplifting.
Yeah.
But it also, like, you know, and it's funny, but it works through some very, like, hard stuff.
I thought the way they balanced the heaviness of it with the lightness of it. Because the first season, when you first meet Ted, you think, oh, this guy's just, like, got it all together. He's positive. Mm-hmm. And then you find out that a lot of that is just coping.
Yeah.
You know, he's just trying to get through every day and mm-hmm. he doesn't. And the way they did that was so well done, I thought.
Yeah.
So well done. Did you ever watch that TV show Wayne? Remember I mentioned that? I saw it on Prime. It was just one season, but that was a great, great show.
I think I might have started it with my wife and we didn't finish it, but.
Yeah. It's different.
Yeah.
But it's also the same. So anyway, well, Tyler, this has been great, man.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate taking you a moment and coming and sitting down with me and chatting about this. Yeah. I think this is a incredibly important issue. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, I find that when I feel connected to myself, that's when I feel like I don't feel like I need that. I'm able to deal with adversity so much more easily, more effectively, maybe is a better word. And it comes about, you know, the first podcast episode I did, you know, I started out quoting E.E. Cummings' poem, "May I Be I Is the Only Prayer." And I think about that a lot, and I probably ought to think about it every day because that really is it. I mean, I think that's the solution to so many problems that we have is that we are trying to be somebody else. You know, he says, "May I be I is the only prayer, not may I be good or great or beautiful or kind." No, all those will come if they come, but may I be I. And when you are yourself and comfortable with yourself and not trying to be somebody else or perform for somebody else, then I think it's easier to be vulnerable. I think it's easier to apologize because you're not worried about wearing this mask anymore.
Yeah.
And so let's just end with that. Let's just say, may I be I is the only prayer.
May I be I is the only prayer.
Amen.
Amen.
Okay. Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott.
All right.